20. Tony fell, not toward the playing field, but to the side, where the stone staircase came up, his body flumping heavily onto the landing where the steps turned. It was a drop of no more than 9 or 10 feet, but a violent contortion, almost as if he intentionally wrenched himself off the landing and into the air, sent him over the edge of that as well, and he plummeted another 20 feet to the stony ground. There he landed on his back, and this time he lay still. For a moment, Gideon was frozen, so utterly thunderstruck that he couldn't move. What just happened? When he'd first seen Tony barreling into him, he'd thought for a millisecond that Tony had burst into tears, that this was an anguished embrace, a plea for help. But only for a millisecond. If Gideon hadn't been turning at the time, Tony would have smashed into his unprotected back, and it would have been Gideon who had been launched into space, and would now be lying there 30 feet below. But what on earth had made? He jerked his head to shake the cobwebs loose, and started quickly down the steps. Tony was moving a little now, he could see. A gentle, circular motion of his left forearm, fingers slightly curled, like an orchestra conductor calling forth a slow, pianissimo passage. He had drawn up his knees, too. He didn't seem to be in pain, there were no obviously broken limbs, and Gideon could see no blood. He knew better than to think there would be no grave injuries, however. Nobody could fall 10 feet onto a stone platform, and then an additional 20 feet onto hard, stony ground, flat on his back both times, which meant he had to have struck his head as well, and then walk away as if nothing had happened. When he reached Tony, he saw that he was right. Tony's eyes were open, and they followed Gideon, but the rims of both eyes had brown residue on them, a sure sign of intracranial hemorrhaging. He had taken out his cell phone on the way down, but he didn't know Mexico's equivalent of 911. Instead, he dialed the hacienda. Annie picked up on the first ring.
Good morning, she sang. Buenos dias.
Annie, this is Gideon. I'm at Yagul. Tony's had an accident, a fall. Serious.
He caught the shocked intake of breath. Serious? What do you mean, serious? He's not...
He's alive, but I think he suffered a brain injury. Can you get an ambulance here?
Yes, of course. Is he? Never mind. I'll call right away. My God.
She clicked off. Gideon knelt beside him. Tony's eyes continued to follow. There was a glob of blood in one nostril, and a thin trickle from his right ear. The nasal blood might be nothing, but the bleeding from the ear? That was another bad sign. Tony, he said softly. What was that about? Tony looked at him with an expression of mild curiosity. He made no attempt to speak. His arm was still making its slow circles. Gently, Gideon took hold of his wrist and laid it on his chest. It stayed there. Tony, can you hear me? No reply. Tony was watching Gideon's lips. The pupil of his left eye was a pinpoint. The other seemed normal. Another indicator of an injured brain. There wasn't much doubt about it now. Tony was mostly on his back, but his head and hips were twisted to opposite sides. The position looked unpleasant, but Tony didn't look uncomfortable. Gideon knew better than to try to straighten him out. Do you know who I am?
Creo que sí.
I think so. Gideon waited for a name, but none came. Do you know who you are? He asked quietly.
¿Quién sabe?
He said, sounding too weary to care. Who knows? Then his eyes rolled up, and his eyelids fluttered a few times and closed. Tony? No reply. Gideon put a hand on his chest to make sure he was still breathing. He was, but raggedly. The trickle of blood from his ear now ran all the way to the back of his head and dripped slowly onto the ground. The blood at his eyes and nose was about the same as before. Gideon settled down on the ground to wait with him, his mind whirling. What the hell just happened? Several groups of visitors had arrived by now, and although everyone else kept well clear of the two men, a Mexican tour guide came up to ask if there was anything he could do. Not unless you're a doctor, Gideon said. The man had seen the entire terrible incident, however. How the other man had tried to push him off the platform, and he offered his name and telephone number if a witness were needed. Gideon, realizing for the first time that a witness might indeed be a very good thing to have, gratefully accepted his business card. Vicente Abelardo, Tours Arqueológicos, City Tours, Bike Rides y Otros. The ambulance, a brand spanking new orange and white van from the hospital in Tlacolula, came bouncing up to them, right onto the edge of the playing field, spraying dust and gravel. At almost the same time, another one of the hacienda vans pulled up, with Annie at the wheel and Julie in the passenger seat. The two ambulance attendants were professional and quick. A few brief questions that he was able to understand and answer in Spanish. How long had he been unconscious? Was he conscious at all after the fall? Has he vomited, convulsed, shown evidence of pain? Shown any movement below the neck? Gideon answered them all and added his observation about the difference in pupil size. They glanced at each other, saying nothing. What could they say? Then got swiftly down to work, while Gideon moved off to the side with Annie and Julie to watch. Tony's head and neck were immobilized in a plastic cradle with head and chin straps, and then he was expertly slid onto a board, strapped to it, and hauled into the back of the ambulance. Tony's lips were moving as he was lifted, but his eyes stayed closed. The door slammed shut, and they were gone in another explosion of dirt and gravel. When the ambulance had gotten there, most of the other visitors to the site came to gawk, but now they rapidly dispersed, murmuring among themselves. It had turned into an exciting day for them after all.
Julie, would you mind driving back with Gideon? A distracted, lip-biting Annie asked. I want to go to the hospital to be with Tony. Of course, go ahead.
She started to leave, then stopped and took Gideon's hand.
Thank you for taking care of him.
He smiled weakly but said nothing. In fact, everything had happened so quickly since they'd arrived that Gideon hadn't told them what had really happened. He said nothing now either, as he and Julie walked to the van, other than to ask her to drive. She looked at him curiously. He generally enjoyed driving more than she did, but got into the driver's side and turned on the ignition. They followed the ambulance and Annie's van down the dirt road until they came to Highway 190, where the ambulance flicked on its siren and raced south toward the hospital, with Annie closely following, like an airborne bird sheltering in the wake of the leader of the flock. Julie and Gideon turned north, toward Teotitlan. Only then did either of them speak.
It must have been pretty bad, she said. I don't think I've ever seen you so... I don't know, it's like you're in shock. Are you all right?
Sure, I'm all right. Look, when you get to the Teotitlan turnoff, don't take it. Let's keep going. I need to talk to Javier about this.
She looked doubtfully at him. I don't understand. Why would Javier...
Julie, it wasn't an accident. Tony tried to kill me up there.
He tried to...
She swerved rapidly to the side of the road and pulled up on the shoulder.
Did you just say what I think you said?
I'm afraid so. He tried to shove me off the platform. He wound up going over the edge instead.
But why? That's crazy.
He spread his hands. I don't have a clue.
My God. Tell me what happened.
There's not much to tell. I was answering one of his questions about the ball court, and I had my back to him, and I heard... I don't know what I heard. A sob, maybe? And I'd been worried about him anyway because he'd been acting strangely.
Strangely how?
Tense, nervous, preoccupied. He gestured at the ignition. Could we get going again, please?
Gideon, at this point, I think I'm more shaky than you are. I mean, if you hadn't been turning around, if you...
She let out a breath.
Do you feel up to driving? I think it'd be safer.
Yes, I'm okay. The adrenaline rushes over, and so is the knees like jelly follow-up. I'm me again.
I never had the pleasure of the adrenaline rush. I've gone straight to the knees-like-jelly phase. When I think what might have... Phew.
They switched seats, and then Gideon turned the engine on once more and edged out onto the highway. For the next few miles, there was only silence, and then Julie picked up the conversation where they'd left it.
Okay, so you hear what sounds like a sob behind you?
And I turn, and as I turn, here he comes at me. Full speed ahead, Well, I'm not sure what I did. I guess I sort of stepped out of the way and backhanded him. You know, a swipe with my arm to keep him off me. And over he goes, without a sound. Hit the landing on the stairs, bounced off, and fell the rest of the way down.
And hit his head, obviously.
I couldn't be positive at the time, but yes, obviously.
And?
And nothing. I called Annie, and you know the rest. She nodded.
How serious do you think Tony's injuries are?
Serious, Gideon said. Put it this way, if he's lucky, he'll die, because I don't think his brain's going to be of much use to him from now on. Another quiet nod, followed by a soft sigh. How are you feeling about this, Julie? I know you liked him. You must feel...
What I'm feeling, she said firmly, is relief, enormous, overwhelming relief that you're still here.
She reached across to put her hand on his thigh. When he covered it with his own, he could feel it trembling. He curled his fingers gently around it.
What I'm feeling, she went on,
and now the tremble was in her voice as well,
is thank God you acted the way you did, as quickly as you did. If something had happened to you, I can't even...
He squeezed her hand, not trusting himself to speak, thinking for the thousandth time, how fantastically lucky I am to have her, to be loved by this beautiful, marvelous woman.
What I'm feeling about Tony, she continued after a moment in a steadier voice. I haven't sorted that out yet. Disbelief, incomprehension, bewilderment. What could he have been thinking? Was he crazy? What possible motivation could he have to do that to you?
Oh, I think I know what his motivation was. She looked sharply at him.
I thought you didn't have a clue.
Not to his reason, no. But to his motivation, I think so, yes.
You'll have to explain that.
His motivation was to prevent my seeing that skull this afternoon. What else could it possibly be?
Well, almost anything. I don't know. Maybe it had something to do with your identifying Blaze's skeleton.
I guess so, but that's already done. He couldn't do anything to change that. Also, he found out about that yesterday at dinner. He's had all kinds of time to cook up some more subtle, less risky way to do me in between then and now. I don't know. Poison, an accident, whatever. But he didn't. Then at, what was it, about 8 o'clock this morning, he finds out I'm going to look at the skull this afternoon, and 2 hours later he's shoving me off a wall in a public place. I can hardly imagine a more desperate, clumsy, dicey way to try to kill somebody. Why was he in such a hurry?
Because he had no time to plan anything fancier, Julie said, nodding. Because we were going into Oaxaca at noon.
That's the way I see it.
Yes, you're right, I think.
But why was he so afraid of your seeing the skull? Ah, see, that's what I meant about the reason part. That's the part I don't know. As usual, Marmolejo didn't seem to be doing much of anything when they got to his office. He was standing at one of the big mullioned windows, Demitasse cup and saucer in his hands, tranquilly contemplating the peaceful scene in the plaza below. As always, he had on an embroidered white caibera worn outside crisply pressed pants. His eyes lit up when he saw Julie, for whom he had a soft spot, and they quickly embraced, with the top of Marmolejo's head coming up to the level of her nose. He called for more coffee at once, and pastries as well, sat them down in the cozy grouping of leather armchairs in one corner of the big room, and started chattering happily about old times.
Javier, this isn't exactly a social call, Gideon said.
Marmolejo's eyebrows rose.
I grieve to hear it, he waited expectantly.
Telling him about what had happened at Yagul took 5 minutes. Explaining to him who Tony Gallagher was, and the whole twisted story of the Gallaghers and their Byzantine history, took half an hour, most of it provided by Julie. Corporal Vella had brought in coffee and a plate of chocolate wafers. Only Gideon, suddenly ravenous, had eaten any of the wafers, wolfing down 4 of them, when Marmolejo,
called a pause to ask Vela to contact the hospital in Tlacolula about Tony's condition. The coffee had been drunk, and Vela had brought in another serving in fresh demitasse cups.
"And so you believe this attack occurred because he was afraid of what you might find when you looked at the skull?"
Marmolejo asked, as he spooned in his usual 2 teaspoons of sugar.
"There was no history of animosity between you?"
"None. It's got to be the skull."
Marmolejo stirred, tapped the tiny spoon elegantly against the cup's rim, and laid it soundlessly down in the saucer.
"And of what do you think he was frightened?"
"We talked about that in the car," Julie answered, giving Gideon a chance at another couple of wafers. "All we could come up with was that he was afraid that the skull would turn out to be Manolo's. At breakfast this morning, we told him that we thought it might be."
"And if it was, why should that cause him concern?"
"Well, if he murdered Manolo, and if he killed Blaze as well, and wouldn't it make sense that the same person killed them both, and..."
She shrugged.
"Then what? Let's say he did kill them. Why should identifying the skull as Manolo's, if indeed it should turn out to be, bring suspicion down on Tony Gallagher in particular?"
"We couldn't come up with any reasonable answer for that either, Javier," Gideon said, swallowing a slug of coffee to wash down the wafers. "We also couldn't think of any reason for Tony to kill them in the first place. He wasn't a betrayed husband or a jealous lover, after all. He was Blaze's brother."
"I wonder if we're barking up the wrong tree altogether," Julie said thoughtfully. "Maybe you're going to look at the skull doesn't have anything to do with what happened in Yagul. Maybe it is just an old Zapotec skull after all, and not Manolo's."
"That could be," Gideon said. "But my intuition's sure telling me otherwise. In any case, we'll find that out this afternoon."
At this point, Corporal Vela came in with a sheet of paper for Marmolejo.
"Gracias, Alejandro," he said, and scanned the few typewritten lines on it.
"It's about Mr. Gallagher. The hospital says his condition is critical but has stabilized. He is in a coma designated as a 5 on the Glasgow scale." He looked at Gideon. "Is this something with which you're familiar?"
"Yes, a little. The Glasgow coma scale."
"Wait, start at the beginning," Julie said. "What is a coma? He was already unconscious when they took him away. When does being unconscious turn into a coma exactly?"
"Well, there is no exactly. A coma is just a state of protracted unconsciousness. A boxer who's knocked out and gets up a few seconds later wasn't in a coma. If he's still unconscious at the hospital an hour later, that's a coma. If he's still in it a month later, they usually reclassify it to a persistent vegetative state. If he's still in it a year later, well, then he's almost certainly never going to wake up."
"And this Glasgow scale of 5, what does that tell us?" asked Marmolejo.
"Not anything good, I'm afraid, as far as Tony is concerned. It's based on a bunch of basic tests. You know, can he answer a simple question with a yes or a no? Can he move a limb or nod his head if he's asked to? Does he react to being stuck with a pin? The scale runs from a 3, I think, to a 15, with 3 being the lowest you can get."
"So a 5, said Marmolejo, "would not be a very good sign."
"A terrible sign. If I remember correctly, 3 to 5 generally means the person has probably suffered a brain injury that's going to wind up killing him, never going to regain consciousness."
"Can he live a long time like that?" Julie asked.
"Not likely, but it happens. Comas aren't very well understood."
"So," said Marmolejo, "wherever we find our answers to our questions, they are not likely to come from Mr. Gallagher himself."
"I think you can count on that," Gideon said. "Listen, Javier, I want to ask you something. You said nothing could be done about Blaze's murder because the statute's run out."
"Correct."
"And if this skull at the museum does turn out to be Manolo's, the same would apply to him."
"I'm afraid so."
"Well, doesn't what happened today change things?"
"I don't see how." "Yes, of course, we will look into it, but it's a completely separate matter."
"Is it?"
Here's this peaceful little village, Teotitlan, that supposedly hasn't had a homicide in umpteen years, umpteen decades. And now we find out that Blaze Gallagher, or rather, Blaze Gallagher Tendler, was killed 30 years ago, only no one knew about it. And today, one day after I identify her body, and only hours before I go to look at a museum specimen that might be her lover's skull, Tony Gallagher, Blaze's brother, tries to murder me. And what about that mummified guy I looked at the other day? Julie shook her head. Where does he come into it? I thought he was just a drifter who happened to be heading up toward the Hacienda Encantada, and who was found dead, murdered, a few months later out in the desert. That adds up to two certain murders, Blaze and the drifter, one possible murder, Manolo, and one attempted murder, me. He had ticked them off on his fingers, and now he held up his hand. Four. Count 'em. Wouldn't you say that's quite a lot for this peaceful little village? And wouldn't you say the Hacienda connection runs rather distinctly through them all?
And do you think Tony was behind all of them? Julie asked.
I'm not ready to go that far. I can sure tell you he was behind one of them.
Marmolejo had been silent for a few minutes, having gotten up and gone again to the window, where he stood looking out with his hands behind his back.
I take your point, Gideon, he said, without turning around. I expect that we will indeed be taking another look at Blaze's murder, but I'm afraid it will be only to see what light it might cast on the attack on you. To her, the statute of limitations must still apply. If we should discover her killer, there will be nothing we can do about it.
Gideon shrugged. Good enough, I understand. What about this drifter, though? He was killed only a few months ago.
Oh, yes, Manuel Garcia. We're proceeding with that, as we would have in any case. Now, however, I think we will be inquiring more deeply as to what business he had, if any, at the Hacienda. Oh, that reminds me, he turned from the window. I received the report of his autopsy from Mexico City this morning. Apparently it confirms your findings in their entirety.
Stabbed to death with a screwdriver?
He nodded.
The chief examiner telephoned me to express his appreciation to you. Neither the screwdriver impressions in the bone, nor the puncture of the chest wall by a rib was anything he had ever encountered or heard of before. He said he learned much, and that it was an honor to have collaborated with El Famoso Detective de Esqueletos.
Well, please let him know that I appreciate that. Did the report turn up anything new?
I've yet to read it. It's still on my desk. Would you like to see it?
Gee, I wonder what the answer to that's going to be, Julie said to the ceiling.
Gideon smiled. Sure, just for a few minutes anyway.
Marmolejo went to his desk and got a thick, neatly opened envelope that he brought to Gideon.
I can show Julie around the building in the meantime, if she'd like. There are some interesting old corners that not many people get to see.
I'd love it, said Julie.
They were hardly out of their chairs when Gideon, scanning the first page, asked with a distinct edge of excitement, Javier, does Placas y Tornillos de Fijación mean what I think it does?
Placas y Tornillos are...
But Gideon had already flipped to the sheaf of color photographs at the back. They had removed the mummified hide of the head to expose the skull and mandible, and there were photos.
Never mind, he said, staring hard at the very first photograph. I'll be damned. This whole thing gets weirder by the minute. He looked up at them. I don't know what it's all going to add up to in the end, but there's one thing I can tell you right now. Julie, you were absolutely right. Whoever that skull at the museum belonged to, I'd be real surprised if it turns out to be Manolo's.
And why? A frowning Marmolejo asked.
Because, said Gideon, slowly tapping the photograph, that's who this is.